From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, open lines. Looking forward to that. Here's what's happening. Donald Trump is the winner in New Hampshire. You've probably heard that. The Republican primary and Ohio Governor John Kasich takes second place. That's pretty dramatic. The battle for third, though, is still a tough, fierce contest among three candidates: Texas Senator Ted Cruz, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, and Florida Senator Marco Rubio. And an astrologer who's been on Coast to Coast before, Christopher Renstrom, says whoever wins the New Hampshire primary has the best shot to being the president. Well, if that's the case, Bernie Sanders, of course, took the Democratic end in New Hampshire by a wide margin, and Trump. So maybe those will be the two runoff candidates. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Any surprises here, John?
Well, yeah. Well, of course, there's some surprises here, and I think it's the race is, you know, I mean, the punditry, you know, after the Ohio caucus last week, we're saying, oh, Trump lost the race, and, you know, this really shows that he's a loser, and, you know, you heard all this, you know, that he was, you know, somehow, and when you think about it, and I said last week about that thing, it's 24% he got. He only missed the Iowa thing by 4% when he's not an evangelical, and he barely spent any time there. Now he comes into New Hampshire, and he absolutely rocks New Hampshire with this massive 35%+ victory. Yeah. And remember the difference between even Kasich at 2%. They're all huge losers, you know, relative to Trump. When you talk about a second, third, fourth, fifth place finish that goes down to Rubio, what you're looking at is people that are finishing at 11% and 10% relative to 35. He's way up in South Carolina, so he's highly likely to his margin to be similar to this in South Carolina. The surprise was, George, last Saturday night at the debate with Marco Rubio, who has been groomed basically by the establishment, the RNC, is hoping that they could put him into, you know, kind of a mainstream lane or, you know, a moderate track, basically just self-destructed before your eyes, repeating himself like some kind of a tape went off in his head and he couldn't stop it. About, oh, President Obama changing the country. And they can thank Chris Christie for punching this guy in the jaw and literally knocking him out, basically wobbling incoherently in that race. And now you're seeing Rubio basically dropping down to fifth place below Jeb. Now, there's only a half a percent or so that separates Jeb Bush. Bush's finish, and the way they're spinning it is like, oh my God, can you see? He's moved all
he's
the way
moving up
to fourth place. Well, guess what? He's at 11%, and he's going nowhere. So what you've seen out of this is Christie is heading back to New Jersey. I think you can put a fork in him. I mean, you can thank him for what he did with Rubio, but you can put a fork in him. He's done.
See, but all these other votes, John, that did not go to Trump, and there's no doubt Trump won by a landslide. So did Bernie Sanders tonight. But if all these other candidates weren't in the picture, would all those percents, a great deal of those percents, go to the other candidate, not Donald Trump, but whoever was running against him?
No, and I'll tell you why. And here's the basic logic. The voters don't vote for, they typically do not vote for ideology or specifics of, you know, policy, that kind of stuff. They vote for who they believe is most likely to win. Now Trump is being cemented once again, his front runner status, and the perceptions. With you have some dropouts with Christie and whatever, that just provides more votes basically to somebody perceived as the GOP winner, and that will go to Trump.
All right, we'll watch this. Thanks, John. So in about a week and a half, there'll be a Democratic and a Republican runoff in the South Carolina primaries, so those will happen. And then Nevada will be there. All of this gearing up to March 1st for Super Tuesday, where so many states and so many delegates are just out there to grab. So we'll see what happens, but we're watching it. Fascinating so far. The satellite that North Korea launched into orbit Sunday is now stable in orbit. Earlier reports had claimed that the satellite was tumbling in orbit, which would have rendered it useless. A U.S. official says the same technology used to get the payload into orbit is the same needed to launch a nuclear-armed intercontinental ballistic missile at the U.S. The mayor of Hawaii's Big Island declared a state of emergency on Monday to deal with a growing outbreak of the dengue fever spread by infected mosquitoes. 250 cases confirmed over the past few months there. Some strange stories for you in Camden, New Jersey. A southern New Jersey man has been found guilty of stabbing his downstairs neighbor to death in a dispute over pet birds. The neighbor, who was living underneath him, had birds on the porch and they were chirping too loud, so the guy got mad and killed his neighbor. A 17-year-old boy who once weighed, get this, 1,345 pounds, 17 years old, then has walked for the first time in his teenage life. He has lost 700 pounds since being on an intensive hospital fitness routine. Amazing. A Connecticut man has been arrested after police concluded that he had been faking cancer in order to collect fundraising money. He was arrested for taking $22,000 from people after they held benefits for him to raise money after he claimed to have a very rare form of brain cancer. And a goat has been arrested in India, accused of repeatedly damaging a judge's garden by eating flowers and plants there. So police went and arrested the goat. Can't believe it. NOAA forecasters estimating a 40% chance of minor geomagnetic storms. I just hope they continue to stay minor, because one day we're going to say the big one has hit. Let's check in with Stephen Cates with his weekly sky report. Dr. Sky.
Hi, George. There's so much going on in the sky, as you mentioned, with the sun. It's pretty quiet right now. But back to the story you were talking about the North Korean satellite. And many folks out there probably heard this news, but just in case you didn't, George, about an hour after the Super Bowl was over, this particular spacecraft, the North Korean satellite officially known as the Kwangmyongsong 4, or simple English, the Shining Star, literally went about 50 miles away from Silicon Valley, about 250 miles above the Earth. Now, if that's by coincidence, so be it. But what we have up on the DrSky.com site right now, George, is an interesting satellite tracker where people can actually track in real time, this is amazing, this object known as KMS-4. And right now, as I'm looking at my screen, it literally is over the South Pole right now, traveling at some 17,000 miles an hour, as you would expect. But to talk further about this spacecraft, it comes to a low altitude of about 284 miles in space above the Earth and to a high altitude of about 312 miles. That's not in any harm's way for the space station. But what's interesting, George, is that people can actually track this if they go to our site right now. This particular link that we have shows everything you'd ever want to know about this particular spacecraft. And your object of the week, always something, George, that people can look forward to in these beautiful skies that we have. If you look now, as the moon is near new, so thus it's not in the sky, if you look in the northeastern part of the sky and see the handle and bowl of the Big Dipper, right above the bowl is where, George, in 1995, the Hubble Space Telescope imaged this thing called the Hubble Deep Field. Is supposed to be.
Oh, I love that picture.
No stars, right. And then what do we find, George? Billions of galaxies in an area where the sky was supposed to be totally devoid. So it's a good area of the sky to take a look at, and just know as you point that out, as you look into the sky, what, George, the whole universe is much larger, much more complex, and it's always fascinating to talk about these subjects. And as I mentioned, on DrSky.com, you can track the North Korean satellite and watch it. But, George, wouldn't that be horrible if this was really a future test of an EMP device?
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
You got it. Thanks, Stephen. Appreciate it. Hey, by the way, our sources tonight are indicating that there will be a scheduled launch of a large Delta IV rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base in Central California in about 5.5 hours. The liquid propellant rocket will use two solid boosters and should be visible for hundreds of miles. It's not a UFO. The hum is a phenomenon involving widespread reports of a persistent and invasive low-frequency humming, rumbling, droning sound not audible to all people. Hums have been widely reported by the national media in the United Kingdom and the United States. What the heck is going on? Up next, Dr. Glenn McPherson joins us. We'll talk about the hum in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Dr. Glenn McPherson is the director of the World Hum Map and the Database Project. He has lectured for 13 to 16 plus years at the University of British Columbia, training future mathematics teachers. He's a researcher as well as a high school teacher of physics, mathematics, psychology, general science, biology. Lots to talk with him about tonight. About the hum. Later we'll take your calls. Maybe you're hearing some of these strange sounds. Dr. Glenn McPherson on Coast to Coast. What a subject, Glenn. People have been calling us for years about this.
Yeah, and the experiences of people who can hear the hum have a great deal in common. And my own experience, what brought me to discover the hum and the hum community is mirrored in the almost 10,000 people now who have made their way into the map and into the database.
First started in the United Kingdom back in the 60s?
Well, that's an important question. The 1970 is actually a key time. What happened was a person wrote a letter to the New Scientist magazine in 1970, and it caused a flood of responses in England. Bristol is the most is the best known hum location, Largs, Scotland, and following that, eventually it came to the United States. 1990, 1991 was the best estimates that we have of the hum's arrival in North America.
And we've been emailing back and forth today, Glenn, between our producers and you, of course, seeing if we had any audio of these hums. And you're not so sure that they're authentic out there, are you?
Well, of course, with any unexplained phenomena, that will invite hoaxes and pranks and that sort of thing. But I think there's a pretty good case to be made, and a pretty good case to be made that the world hum may not be a sound in the traditional sense of the word.
Now, if it's not a sound, what is it?
Well, it's been pretty well established in the research literature. It was suspected back in the late 40s and demonstrated convincingly in the 1960s that the human body is able to perceive sensations, including sound, from electromagnetic energy, including radio waves. It's the microwave hearing effect that has gathered the most attention. I don't think microwaves are the source of the hum. But the notion that radio energy can cause the perception of sound in the body is, I think, the strongest theory right now. And it's the one that I'm pursuing experimentally as well.
So these are sounds being picked up within the body, but not necessarily on the outside of the body where other people could hear it.
Correct.
Huh. If you had 10 people in a group, mm-hmm. and at least one of them heard the hum, how many do you think in that group might have heard it? Just the one?
This is a difficult question. That is, what percent of the population under the right conditions can hear it? Some of the estimates out of the Kokomo, Indiana study would suggest numbers as high as 8 or 9%, which I don't think are correct. I think now, after examining this for 3 or 4 years, we're somewhere between 2% and 4% of the general population under the right conditions can sense this hum.
Are you leaning toward this possibility that the body is picking up these waves, basically, and creating the sound within the body? Is that the way you're headed?
Oh, yeah. There are probably a dozen different hypotheses that have been put forward for the source of this phenomenon. But the fact that you mentioned that around 1970 in England, this phenomenon first appeared in a widespread and reliable way, the fact that it appeared then really rules out a good deal of those hypotheses, and there's only two or three, in my view, two or three strong hypotheses that are yet to be explored. And I decided to start with what I think is the strongest of those theories.
Is this almost like a vibration, Glenn, that the body is picking up?
If you look through the reports on the Hum database, you'll see that a sizable percentage of people report a sense of vibration in the body. Even a couple of the well-known authors who wrote some of the seminal papers on the Hum themselves claimed that they could feel their bed vibrating or objects near them vibrating. Now, I don't experience any of those symptoms, but as you'll also notice from the database, there are great numbers of people who are suffering quite badly from this. For me, the Hum is more of a curiosity than a source of suffering. But the notion of feeling vibrations, headaches, nausea, and in some cases worse, has all been widely reported. And it's and I'm in the process of documenting those stories.
And I've got to guess, Glenn, that once someone through their body begins to pick up on these waves turning into the sound, it's got to drive them crazy because it doesn't stop, I would assume.
I was living in a small town near Vancouver, Canada, in the spring of 2012. And I had assumed that what I was hearing at night were these small float planes flying over the small city. And those planes actually do go over there quite regularly.
Yeah.
But after a few weeks or days of this, I thought, this doesn't sound right. This it doesn't make sense. So I waited for the sound to appear one night, and then I went outside, and the sound stopped. And then I logically assumed that there was something in the house that was creating this noise. And so I went through the standard procedure of, you know, checking the fridge and turning off the power to this appliance and that appliance. And then finally, what I ended up doing is what many Hum hearers do, is I cut the power to the entire house. And then the sound got louder.
Louder?
it got louder. And then I knew I was onto something rather unusual, just because of the background I have. But I approached it quite logically. And so then I figured, all right, let's get in the car. And now, as soon as I stepped outside the house, of course, the sound stopped. Sitting in my car with all the doors closed and the ignition off, I could hear it. So that suggested a natural experiment.
Mm-hmm.
I went for a drive. And I drove around the neighborhood. I drove for several miles. And every time I stopped and turned the car off, the sound was there. At that point, I knew something very unusual was happening. And then I did what I think the vast majority of people do, which is to go to Google. And I typed in something along the lines of unusual low frequency humming noise, something along those lines. And then on that first page, I landed on one of the very few serious scientific papers on this topic, and I was quite shocked. And and then from that time on, I noticed that in that little town where I was living, sometimes the Hum became, you know, it got to the point where I said to myself, well, this is actually a nuisance now. Because the only way that I could get any break from the sound at nighttime was to mask it with some other sound, such as a bathroom fan or some other thing like that,
or music or anything, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And apart from that one episode, again, the Hum is easily masked in my case, just using a bathroom fan and that sort of thing. But for some people, it's more difficult to get relief.
I bet it has got to be causing some people to go crazy. I mean, this constant. I mean, it's almost like we'll get into tinnitus, of course, that constant ringing in people's ears. But this has some similarities to it. Hold on, doctor. We're at the top of the hour. Dr. Glenn McPherson with us. We're talking about this hum. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. Maybe you hear it too. His theories, of course, his thoughts that all these electromagnetic energy waves that are out there coming from different sources, which we'll talk about in a second, are creating noise within the body. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast, back with Dr. Glenn McPherson as we talk about this hum. Glenn, in your opinion, what are the outside sources that contribute to this hum then? Is it an accumulation of cell towers, smart meters? What's doing it?
The best theory that I think we have right now is that the world hum is rooted in radio frequencies of a particular part of the spectrum, that is VLF radio, very low frequency radio, operating between 3 kilohertz and 30 kilohertz. These VLF transmissions come from massive stationary transmitters used by the world's military for communicating with submerged submarines. The United States also has an airborne VLF transmission system known as TACAMO. It's a short for take charge and move out. That theory helps with the timing because the appearance of these massive VLF transmitters coincides with the appearance of the hum in England and to some degree the appearance of the hum in the United States as the TACAMO system in particular came online, and as we saw the proliferation of a large number of transmitters operating on this frequency. VLF radio waves have some very unique properties, which makes them ideally suited for military tech communication. Just as an example, AM radio or FM radio operates mainly by line of sight, but VLF radio waves can do much more than that. They can actually travel between the ground and the bottom layer of the ionosphere. That's the charged layer of our atmosphere, and they can circle the globe with very little loss of power. They can also bounce back and forth between the ground and the sky. Also with very low loss of power. And it's because of these characteristics of VLF waves that I think make them an ideal candidate for at least the first stop for investigating the source of the world hum. And that's the basis of the physical experiments. The actual experimental side of what I do is building on that theory.
These low-frequency waves also come from lightning and natural disturbances. Could they be part of it too?
Well, again, you put your finger on the very troubling piece of data that pretty much eliminates most of the other hypotheses. What changed around 1970 in England that caused the world hum? Now, lightning certainly is responsible for some VLF and in particular ELF radio emissions. In fact, for those listeners who have heard of the Schumann resonances, those in fact are caused by the worldwide lightning discharges. The sources of ELF, the ones that I'm concerned with, are the massive stationary ones, such as the one, the VLF Cutler in Maine, VLF Jim Creek near Oso in Washington State. And of course, all the world's major military powers have their own very large VLF transmitters. Those, I believe, are the culprits, and that's what I'm pursuing.
It's bizarre, isn't it, Glenn?
Yes, it is. And when I first stumbled over the hum community, I did notice that the world hum has been attached to a lot of writing and commentary that, how do I put this, is out on the fringes or perhaps beyond the fringes of what science has accepted. As you may know, the Tau Sum made its way onto the X-Files on one episode, and it's also been mentioned incidentally in a few other places as well. And yes, I'm actually quite hesitant to tell too many people, unless I know them quite well, about my experience with the hum, because as a teacher of psychology, I'm well aware of some of the social risks that can come with the claiming that you can hear things that other people can't hear. So we have a word for that. It's called an hallucination. And pretty convinced that that's not what's going on. But yes, I think it is rather odd.
Does the hum have a uniform tone to it in terms of how loud it gets, or does that change too?
That's one of the questions that I ask on my online survey. I have a good number of questions, but one of the ones that I'm interested in is, what is the pitch, the perceived pitch of the dominant tone that you hear? Now, in my case, it's roughly around 56.5 hertz, which is fairly low down on the piano keyboard. It's a fairly deep dominant tone, but it's not a clean tone. It's a fairly muddy tone, and some people describe it as a distant rumble. For some people, it's more of a electronic machinery operating in the distance. You'll see multiple descriptions for it, but no, there is not a lot of uniformity in some aspects of it. But the people who do report in, and the people who have reported their experience, have a great deal in common, and it's on that basis that we can assume that they're all experiencing the same thing, just as with conditions such as tinnitus, which are also, I might add, completely self-reported.
Are there ways that the body can insulate itself against hearing these hums?
I'm not aware of anything, but perhaps this is a good time just to jump in and talk about tinfoil. Now, you and I know that the tinfoil hat is the very icon of clinical paranoia. Yet there's some great irony in this, and the reason why is because a single layer of foil will block a good deal of electromagnetic energy in the higher frequencies. That's the reason we don't put foil into microwave ovens. However, VLF waves have tremendous penetrating power. And that's why they're used for communication with submerged submarines. It takes quite a bit of solid metal to block VLF waves. And that was one of the design challenges that I faced in building my experimental unit for actually blocking the world hum.
That's an amazing possibility. You know, when I first moved to Los Angeles, was met by a morning talk show host on our affiliate KFI, Bill Handel, who's since become a dear friend. Well, we met at lunch, and he was wearing a foiled helmet. And, right. You know, he was laughing about the show and having fun, but it would probably work, wouldn't it?
Well, I can tell you about some rather disturbing experiments, but they're all fully documented, and I put those references on my research blog. The name Alan Frey, it's Frey, out of England, he was one of the first to, in fact, demonstrate the microwave hearing effect. And I'll just mention that, incidentally, that he found that just a very simple metal cage, a small piece of metal foil, was able to block that microwave hearing effect. Now, I want to repeat, I'm not claiming that that microwaves or cell phone towers or HARP or the LORAN or Gwen towers or smart meters. I'm not claiming that any of those things actually cause the hum, but I think we need to accept the fact that we know that radio energy can be perceived as sound. And if in fact it is VLF frequencies that are causing the hum, simple shielding with foil is useless. It's not going to work. because of the so-called radio skin depth effect, which is very large for these VLF waves. So many of the people who tried to shield from Bahamas failed because they don't understand that concept of radio skin depth.
Just amazing, just what's happening all around this planet. Are there areas now that the hum is heard by the body more than other spots?
That's an excellent question. And if you go take a look at the hum map, that can be a little bit misleading. Like many people, when they first glance at the hum map, and they will look at England in particular and the eastern coast of the United States and go, wow, they're getting clobbered. But the reason that the map shows such a concentration is because of the high population densities in those places. And in fact, if you do a population density overlay map on top of the hum map, you'll see a striking correspondence between the two. The real areas of interest are where the hum reports do not correlate with population density. And I've identified a couple of places just on a quick glance where it appears that hum reports do not follow population density. And the first one that caught my eye was South Dakota. Now, South Dakota has a hum density of about one hum report for every roughly 210,000 people. Now, if you contrast that over to, let's say, Vancouver Island, which is a big island just northwest of Seattle, right, you'll get approximately one hum report for every 17,500 people. And I think it's those statistics that are interesting.
That's a huge difference.
Yes, I'm just starting to generate those stats. And I'm hoping others can step in as well, people with some good background in this type of demographics, and can perhaps point to some trends in that data. So the short answer to your question is just looking at the hum map can be misleading. You need to dig into the numbers a little bit.
Why are some people more receptive to the hum than others?
Well, that is also an excellent question, and it's been suggested that hum hearers have something in common, and that is something anatomical, something whether it's in something in their auditory processing system, something cochlear function. It's difficult to say. I have to say that, and I want to just point out, I'm not a scientist in the traditional sense. That is, I'm not a physicist, or I'm not a chemist. Those people who work professionally in those fields, they are an inch wide and a mile deep, just so they can operate at the top of their field. Because I'm a teacher of all these subjects, and because of my background, I'm a mile wide and an inch deep, meaning that I'm able to pull together items from psychology, from biology, from radio theory, because I have a general working knowledge of all of these topics, and it's pretty much allowed me to weigh the credibility of some of the hypotheses. And I think some of these hypotheses do not have a lot of merit for some reason, and this is on the psychological side. Once a person decides on what they think the source of the hum is, they tend to get quite emotional and quite passionate about it. And I find that an interesting aspect of the phenomenon as well.
Do people literally go nuts listening to this hum?
Yes. Now, again, the word nuts is, maybe we should qualify that.
Maybe we should.
Yeah.
let me say, how about bonkers?
It's been reported that, I haven't seen any supplementary evidence to triangulate this, but it appears that one or two individuals may have taken their own life over the torment. And any sort of noise that is enough to get your attention can have that effect. I mean, even if it's something like loud music coming from your neighbor.
Mm-hmm. I just had a story, doctor, about a guy who lived above another guy who had chirping birds, and he stabbed the guy to death because he couldn't stand the chirping sound.
Yeah, and so noise torture, for example, which I think many people will know was used by the North Koreans during some of their brainwashing type treatment of POWs. Noise always plays a role in psychological torture, in military intelligence operations. Noise is a classic weapon, and so if noise can be used as a weapon intentionally, it can also be used. It can also be quite tormenting, even if the source is not intentional.
Well, that's true. How did you get involved in this? Because you heard this too, or what led you to really want to investigate this?
I felt that there really needed to be a serious and disciplined place for commentary, for people to go, because, as I mentioned previously, some of the material out there on the hum really doesn't sit well with my background. I have a fairly classic rational scientific background. I do have an open mind, and I think I can demonstrate that because of the theory that I'm pursuing right now. But I felt there needed to be a disciplined approach, and also to reach out to people who have scientific credentials.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been a very long struggle to try to bring this into the mainstream. And there's been some talk recently on the Hum forums about the difficulty of bringing this into the mainstream, about what's going on with the Wikipedia article on the Hum. It's pretty clear to me that, and I mean, I can't really come to any other conclusion except that there's one or two people who are hell-bent on keeping this project off of Wikipedia. Numbers of individuals around the world, including myself, have tried to go in and edit Wikipedia on this topic, and those edits are instantly reversed.
Jeez.
And that's a little bit frustrating. I don't think there's any conspiracy here on that point, but it is frustrating. And by the way, just with enough effort from listeners who are familiar with Wikipedia, that for example could be brought to a halt in several days. Just if enough people weighed in and just decided that no, this is going to appear on Wikipedia and therefore it can be taken seriously.
Couple other theories. People have thought that they might be tectonic plates all over the planet, something big happening, or digging for underground caverns.
Yeah.
And I think they could be doing that, but I'm not sure that's what causes the hum.
No, I haven't explored some aspects of this, including that last theory that you mentioned. But again, whenever I'm talking with people about the world hum, I think we just have to come back to the timing. It's all about the timing. Now, there are people who have suggested, for example, that the hum is not a new phenomenon, that it goes back. There's some people who claim that there were interactions between some of the early Spanish explorers and Native Americans on the West Coast who had conversations about an unusual noise. And there are I've actually stumbled over some really intriguing references in the Times of London going back into the 1800s, but those for me are sideline avenues of inquiry. And so I'm sticking with, I only have so much time. I'm a full-time high school teacher and I do have other things in my life that I have to attend to. And so there have been a number of these theories, and I mentioned a few of them before. And again, some people are very passionate. Probably the one that comes up the most is HAARP.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up too. Let's talk a little bit about HAARP when we come back. Plus, we'll have an hour to go of phone calls. And if you are hearing these hums, check in with your own thoughts. We'll be back in a moment.